What a good dog.
Yes, you are.
What a good dog.
Yes, you are.
What a good dog.
Yes, you are.
Yes, you are. Oh, yes, you are.
What a good dog. If my dog is listening right now, I'm talking to you, Poppy. Right. There's an old saying, there are no bad dogs, just badly trained dogs. Or maybe it's not an old saying, I just made it up. So the idea is to figure out how to find the dog that you can train to be the dog you want as a companion. Joining us now to talk about that and more is animal behaviorist Dr. Megan Herron. She is the head of the Behavioral Medicine Clinic at the OSU Veterinary Medical Center. And she's the author of a chapter in a new book called Decoding Your Dog. The Ultimate Experts Explain Common Dog Behaviors and Reveal How to Prevent or Change Unwanted Ones. Welcome to the show, Ultimate Expert.
Thanks for having me in.
I should say welcome back. The chapter you co-wrote for the book is called Choosing Your New Best Friend, How to Find the Best Match for You and Your Puppy. Sometimes it's not a puppy, though, either. Sometimes it's an older dog that you're getting from the pound or from a particular group that does...
Or your next-door neighbor.
Or your next-door neighbor who's moving away and can't take the dog with them, kind of a thing. So... first of all, not everyone is looking for a new best friend.
That's right.
They think a dog will be good for their kid, or they think it'll be a good watchdog.
Sure.
They aren't thinking about friendship necessarily or their relationship with the dog. Should they?
Absolutely. And I think there's a number of reasons why people might be prompted to get a pet. Some people are maybe looking for that animal to have more of a working role for protection, for helping with livestock, things like that. Others are really looking for a family member. I think things have changed dramatically in the last few decades as far as what a pet means in a home. I mean, 30 years ago, did you see dogs sleeping in people's beds? Did we see them even seeing a veterinary behaviorist?
Not that my parents would ever know about, but...
Right. Yeah, so but certainly things are changed where they're really taking on a family role. They're thoroughly in... consistently integrated into the family unit at this point.
You made the point 30 years ago, would you have seen a behaviorist? And the idea that someone like you exists and is trained the way you are tells us a lot about how complicated dogs really are.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think as we are able to integrate them more into the human environment and put more human expectations on them, we're seeing sometimes there can be some issues with that. And so I think from the beginning, if you can try to find that pet that best fits your lifestyle, your needs, and your family, really looking beneath the surface of whether a dog is cute, whether it's the right size, has a curly hair or straight hair, it's really about their personality and what you're looking for as a good match. And that's what our chapter really focuses on.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Dr. Megan Herron. She's an animal behavior expert and the head of the Behavioral Medicine Clinic at OSU's Veterinary Medical Center. If you have a question or comment about animal behavior, about finding that new puppy or that new adoptee, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Okay, so you talk about breeds in your chapter. Breeds are about more than just looks.
Absolutely. So breeds come from, a purpose. Originally, a lot of these breeds were created for different jobs, different working aspects, not necessarily just to be cute and look good and sit on your couch or your lap. And so I think people really need to keep that in mind. And someone once asked me, really, what's the most important thing someone has to think about when getting a pet? And I really say it's your lifestyle. How much time do you have? How much energy do you have? And really, what are your goals for that pet? Because you want a beautiful border collie. They look good. They're very smart. I mean, very, very smart. But you don't have the time or the lifestyle to really give that dog a job. You're going to have some problems there. I mean, these dogs are going to find a job for themselves, and sometimes that's not what we want.
Smart is great. There's a list of the 10 smartest breeds and that kind of thing in the book, but smart isn't always good.
Smart is complicated.
Smart is more complicated.
That means you've got to keep up.
It's like everyone wants a smart kid, too, but it's complicated.
It's complicated, absolutely. So they can learn from their behaviors, both good and bad. And so if they find certain behaviors that are fulfilling to them, fulfills that outlet for the desire to to herd, for the desire to use their brain, to work their minds, to hunt for food, to be destructive. You know, if that comes across in your regular household, often that's where we lead to some problematic or what we would call undesirable behaviors to people that are actually potentially normal behaviors for a dog.
Do you have people coming to you with something like a herding type breed saying, why is this dog always doing X, Y, and Z? They don't even know.
And again, you're going to have a variety in every breed. I'll have mm-hmm. people come to me who've owned a working dog or a herding dog, you know, in the past, who didn't seem to have such a drive. But then you get one more on that other end of the bell curve that's highly driven, needs to work, needs to have a job. And if there is not an outlet provided for that animal constantly, we start to see other problems evolve. And they're sort of, you know, befuddled as to why they're seeing these problems. Why is my border collie staring at my washing machine? Or why is he picking up all of the leaves in the backyard and putting them in a pile and staring at them? Or staring at his own reflection or herding imaginary prey. I mean, I've had a lot of these dogs.
I would imagine sometimes it's like a puzzle when you're trying to figure out a mixed breed dog and what it is that's driving them. You may not know that there's some border collie in it
sure.
or something like that.
Sure. And really we can see these abnormal behaviors can really show up in any breed. They just tend to be a little more some of them tend to be more prominent in some of the dogs that are higher intelligent, are higher drive, and maybe don't have the right outlet for that.
You made an interesting comment in the book about how realize that what you might remember of a breed as a child, mm-hmm. the one you grew up with, may not be reality when you're the grown-up.
Sure. I think a lot of us make very emotional decisions when we're picking out a dog. And so we have these fond memories of a dog as a child, where as a child, we might not have been the primary caretaker for that dog. So we may not have even been aware of what was necessary for that dog. We also have to think how the breed has evolved and changed over decades. And you also have to think about who's breeding the dog, what genetics are in this individual, and they can be vastly different. So it may not be that same dog, may have similar looks, and so we have that emotional attachment to it. You know, when I worked over at the Franklin County Dog Shelter back in my vet school and post-vet school days, I would see that a lot. Well, I had a dog who looked just like this, and they have that emotional attachment, and then there's that expectation that that dog's got to meet that same role that that other dog played, and this dog is its own individual, is probably going to be a complete 180 difference from that original dog's. And then you come with disappointment and frustration and kind of knowing that you really have to work to shape that dog. And if it's an adult dog, it may come with its own behaviors that have already been shaped.
To what extent do you warn people about the expectation problem when they have just lost a beloved dog and they want to turn right around and get another one?
Sure. And that's a really common thing, because to lose, like I said, these are family members for a lot of us now. And so to lose a beloved pet really, it leaves a big hole, and there's a grieving process. And so I usually encourage people to go through that process until they really feel ready to add another companion to their home. And then really to try to think about, okay, let's think about not what your previous dog was, but what is your lifestyle now? What are you looking for? What is the primary reason you want to have a pet? And then we go through, is that better to have as a puppy? Are we looking for an adult? What breed's going to fit us right? And what resource do we want to get that? And where can we get the most information about a dog? Because it may be a family, you know, who adopted a dog, you know, in their college years, and now they've got two or three young children. So adopting a dog's a whole different story when right. you have that kind of family dynamics.
Well, let's hear from Beckett now in Columbus. Beckett, you want some advice for getting a dog with a small baby in the house?
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We recently lost our 15-year-old dog, Zoe. And
sorry,
I just want to say that OSU Veterinary Companion Animal, the hospital was amazing. Mm. So we love the experience there. So thank you to everyone over there.
That.
But we just have a question. Our daughter's almost going to be two, and we're worried about getting a puppy because we don't want that dog to be just beat up by our baby. I mean, she doesn't really know.
Oh, you're worried about the dog.
Yeah. So we're wondering what might be the best choice. Do we go with a shelter where we don't know the history of the dog, but they seem to have a good temperament, demeanor in the shelter, and people seem to be confident that the dog would be okay in our household? Or is it a better idea to just start fresh with a puppy when you have a small child? And I'll go ahead and take my answer off the air. Thank
All
you
right.
so much.
Yep. Thanks, Beckett.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and we hear a lot. And it's really kudos to you for really doing your homework rather than just going out and buying a dog without knowing what's going to be appropriate for your daughter. You said your daughter is almost two, is that correct?
Almost two, that's what she said, yeah.
And so that's an age where kids are at their most unpredictable and at their most mobile, sort of in that tipsy way, you know, waddling around, moving in unpredictable ways. They're very verbal. They're also imitating what mom and dad do, saying, no, bad doggy, get off the couch. Things that we as adults might get away with, but for children, that might be a little intimidating for a dog. And so I think there are benefits both of getting a puppy as potentially there are with getting an adult. So some of the benefits of getting a puppy is that if you can get them within their socialization period, so that's about 3 to 12 weeks of age, then you have that opportunity to socialize that puppy, to know that that puppy can be exposed to children, to see them as a good thing, to see them as safe and as a family member, and not therefore be afraid of them or have those concerns about aggression problems later. The downside of a puppy is that as a mother of an almost two-year-old, I imagine your life is pretty hectic. So you're going to be working with, you know, having your two-year-old schedule and then potty training and crate training and basic obedience training and mouthing training. I mean, it's almost a full-time job raising a puppy. So there's definitely, you want to think about what your lifestyle is like and what time you have for a puppy. Whereas some of the benefits of already, you know, a dog who's already an adult dog is that if you can find a resource where you can get some information about that dog, hopefully you're getting a dog who's already hopefully been socialized to children, who's house trained, who's crate trained, who's not coming with destructive or mouthy behavior problems. So some of that work's already been done for you. The caveat to that is that a lot of these dogs come with a lot of unknowns. And so what I usually recommend to parents who are wanting to go for more of an adult dog, looking to rescue or get a shelter or rescue dog, is to look into dogs that are in foster care already with children. So Franklin County, Capital Area, most of the rescues around Columbus, there's a number of them, typically have a pretty extensive foster care program. And so what you want to do is you can usually read about them online, go to Pet Finder and find these dogs that are in foster care with children or who come with a history of living with children. And, you know, you have to weed through it because some of these histories aren't always honest. You know, people want the best for their dogs. They're giving up and they may not disclose that their dog didn't do well.
Maybe their history of living with children wasn't a positive history.
And
the children were allowed to tease the dog or something like that.
Exactly. So it's something you want to look into. And then you need to be the ultimate judge of the interaction. And so what I used to watch interactions all the time at the shelter, you know, trying to help people find the right match. And, what you want to see is a dog who shows more interest in your daughter than even you, more than the adults. So who sees a child and just turns into one complete wiggly mess. So not just a tail wag, but the rump wag and the shoulder wag and the head wag where I'm so excited, I'm so happy. You want to see happy, wiggly, relaxed. And what I would often see when I would watch these interactions is a dog who is happy, wiggly, relaxed, and approaching mom and dad and just sort of avoiding the kids. They weren't showing overt fear, they weren't showing an aggression, but they were just subtly avoiding them. And to me, that's a huge red flag. That tells me that dog is subtly uncomfortable, and that once we get into a comfortable, quiet setting where that dog's suddenly trapped by a child, I'm worried about problems. So you want to try to find, I would say my best would be either finding a puppy between, you know, the ages of eight and 12 weeks of age. If you're going through the breeder route, doing your homework, meeting the parents, finding out the behavior of both parents, interviewing people who've purchased puppies from previous litters to find out what their behavior is like and how they do with children. A breeder who has the puppies in the household, learning to live in a house and not necessarily solely an outdoor kennel environment. And that way you can raise this puppy. But again, that comes if you've got the time for it, because there's a whole lot of work you got to do with a puppy and raising them.
So the time that my dog literally dragged me through the mud to get to our next door neighbor boys because she was so happy to see him, that's a good thing.
That's a good thing.
Okay. All right.
As long as she's not knocking him down.
No, she just wanted to see them.
And happy Wiggly. That's what you want. Happy Wiggly.
Dr. Megan Heron, she is our guest this hour. She is an animal behavior expert and the author of one of the chapters in a new book. It's called Decoding Your Dog. The ultimate experts explain common dog behaviors and reveal how to prevent or change unwanted ones. If you have a behavioral question about your dog, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back with some calls when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Megan Heron. She is an animal behavior expert at OSU and one of the experts that contributed to a new book called Decoding Your Dog. If you have a question or comment about your dog's animal behavior or a dog's animal behavior, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Richard in Cleveland, you're on the air. Welcome, Richard. Richard, you have to turn down your radio. Richard? Okay. I guess we'll try somebody else. Sean in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Well, me and my girlfriend moved in together about 4 months ago, and during the time we knew we wanted a dog, and we've always lived with animals, and we decided that, well, at least I decided to undergo a virtual treasure hunt for the perfect dog that matched our personality. And we found it through a pet finder and through other sources, and it was a Shiba Inu. And he's just incredibly rambunctious, but at the same time, he's polite about how he is with other people, and he's just wonderful. And I couldn't have been more happy with getting him, because we've always loved having little footsteps in the house.
So he's an adult. Did you get him from a rescue?
Oh, no, I actually, it was kind of a battle between me and my girlfriend, because she's very, well, she wouldn't want me saying this, but she's impatient, and you can see that through our dog as well. She kind of picks up on that, but we got him through a Petland, but we would have preferred to get him through a breeder, at least I would have, but I felt that when we got him through Petland, he had been a little bit more acclimated to other people. So it was easier for him to, get along with others, because he's been in that environment for so long.
Hmm. Okay. You know what, Sean, I am going to move on to Becky, who also has a Shiba Inu, but has some questions about it.
All right, go ahead.
So thanks a lot, Sean. Take care.
Congrats.
Yeah. Hi, Becky. Tell us, what is a Shiba Inu?
Oh, hi, Aunt. It's a Japanese dog.
Okay.
I believe it's it's not a working dog or anything like that. She's about medium size, my dog, around 30 pounds. Anyway, my question was, I just wondered, she licks her paws obsessively. She's alone in the house. We only have one dog. And I don't know how to interest her. I think she does it because she's bored, but I can't find anything that, you know, will interest her. She doesn't like toys. She doesn't chew on things. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do about that.
Have you talked to your vet about first? Because usually the first thing we think about with licking is, does she have a skin problem? Does she have an allergy
problem? My dog was allergic.
Yeah, sometimes it's the base of the toenails can have a little yeast infection in them, or if they have some sort of environmental allergy. Rather than getting sneezy and snotty like we might when we have allergies, they get skin itches. So that was the first thing I would do, is talk to your vet to make sure she doesn't have some allergies. Sometimes with the feet, they can have a food allergy.
My dog was allergic to chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And we were feeding her chicken jerky every day.
Feet and face itching often means a food allergy. So you can, that would be the first thing to do, would be to talk to your vet about maybe that's part of it. And what can happen is, as they lick because their feet itch, they can get little infections. And then it's a vicious cycle of, I'm chewing my feet because they itch, and now they're infection and how it works. And then if it stresses her out, it can make it worse too.
Okay.
If
we hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah.
We feed her pretty high quality food.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't even.
And it's not even about the quality. It's about her being allergic to one of the ingredients. It could be chicken, it could be fish, it could be beef.
Right.
You know, some of these dogs have allergies to some of the highest quality meats out there. It's just that their body mounts a reaction to it. And if your veterinarian looks at it and it looks like the skin looks completely healthy, that there is no evidence that she is itching, and you do think, because we can see dogs who will nervous lick. It's sort of a displacement behavior of, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling worried. Sometimes from boredom, but it's more about worry and anxious. And sometimes when they're home alone, if there's some separation anxiety, they will lick as sort of a coping mechanism. That repetitive behavior sometimes releases endorphins, and it can be a little bit addicting. What we'll do is we try to give them another oral outlet. And so often, if she's not a big player, doesn't like toys, sometimes if we make those toys taste really good, they can be a little more interesting. So puzzle toys. So things like a Kong, are you familiar with that type of toy? A Kong toy?
The big rubber, the real hard rubber? Yeah.
Go into any pet store and say, I need a Kong, and they'll know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay.
And basically, Kongs, I say they're like tofu. They're very boring by themselves. It's all how you flavor it. So you find, you know, if your dog ends up going on a special diet, you find out what kind of diet she can have in the canned version. You stuff that Kong full of canned food, you pop it in the freezer, and you've got a nice puppy popsicle. And then anytime you anticipate her to be stressed out, worried, start to lick her feet, you say, hey, I'm going to give you part of your breakfast or part of your dinner in this little Kong toy and let you lick that instead. So it's sort of a healthy coping mechanism, if that makes sense. And that's been very helpful for a lot of these guys who just, their coping mechanism when they're nervous is to start using their mouth, and it's a more productive way to use that. But I would go to your vet first, rule out allergies, and then look towards these other tools.
All right, Becky, thanks a lot for the call. An email from Carly says, my ex-wife trained the last two dogs to bark continually while she is on the phone. How can you undo that behavior? I'm so glad you emailed, Carl, because I don't even want to know why someone would do that. But
maybe by accident.
Maybe by accident, but barking.
Yes.
Lots of dogs bark at inappropriate times.
Sure. Barking is a big problem, and it's a nuisance problem. It's a neighbor problem. And I would say... it causes a lot of dogs to lose their homes and also potentially go through some, you know, horrific surgeries to try to stop that problem, which is a whole nother show we'll talk about another day. But, you know, really the first thing about barking is you've got to figure out the motivation. There's a number of reasons why dogs will bark. There are dogs who will bark when they are alerted by something outside. So it's a strange noise, potential intruder. We'll call that alarm barking. We'll have dogs who will bark at their owners because they've learned it gets them something. Gets me a treat. It gets me a pet. It gets me attention. It gets you off the phone. and you'll also have dogs who will bark out of dementia. They just are confused. They're not quite sure what's going on. And really the way to find it out is to think about, what do you feel like your dog's barking at? Is your dog barking at something outside? Well, then we treat that a little differently. And is the dog barking at you because you feel like the dog wants something? And if it's barking at you because he wants something, it probably means you've given him what he wants in that time frame.
Or
so we have to
has.
Think about, first of all, never providing any reinforcement or reward for that type of barking. So if he wants to play, he wants to pet, he wants attention, if he's barking at you, we have to really be strong about, I'm not going to look at you, I'm not going to talk to you, I'm not going to touch you when you're doing that behavior. As long as you know it's not about this dog has to go to the bathroom or there's really a need that that dog needs addressed. So the first thing is trying to make sure all those needs are addressed by, okay, I'm going to give you a lot of physical stimulation, so I'm going to exercise the heck out of you. I'm going to then give you some mental stimulation. So usually a lot of these dogs, they need to use their brain, not just go for that long walk. And then we also need to give them some social interaction. So those are the basic needs that most dogs, if we can get fulfilled, are going to do less of that barking at you for attention. And so that long walk, bring them down by doing 5 to 10 minutes of a training session. Sit with them, give them one-on-one social time with petting or massage. Tellington touch for dogs who like massage is a wonderful way to kind of bring them down several notches. And then we get out one of those frozen Kongs and sort of the time of day where you need to get some work done. You need to make a lot of phone calls. Here's that frozen foodstuff Kong. If your mouth's on that, it's not barking at me. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then really try your best not to give any sort of attention. If they bark while you're on the phone, go into another room and close the door so they don't have access to you, and learning that barking might get you off the phone.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Dr. Megan Heron. She's an animal behavior expert at OSU Veterinary Medical Center. Let's take another call real quick. Connie in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Connie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm enjoying the program. I'm a great dog lover, and for the last 30 years, I've had Dobermans. I think they're a fabulous breed. I have a Dobie now who is 5 years old, had him since he was a very small puppy, about 6 weeks old, and he's very well socialized. He's mannerly. He's loving. Oh, he's really loving, but he has a particular... tech, if you will, when he gets excited, when we get up in the morning, it's time to go outside. When we walk outside to take a walk, and he's excellent. He minds perfectly off the leash, except when he's excited at the beginning of things and he spins in very tight circles. And you can imagine this is a 90-pound dog.
tight circle is relative.
Hard to get a leash on
really
that.
Close to me, and he banged my legs are bruised up from it a lot of the time. It's dangerous for him to do this, and when he does it, He has an incredibly high-pitched, piercing bark that he does at the same time. And I just love him to death, and I don't know what to do. People say, well, he's just wired that way, and there's nothing you can do. And I kind of refuse to accept that. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, there probably are things you can do, but it's definitely not going to be a quick or easy fix by any means. It sounds like a behavior he's learned is part of the pattern. Well, we go for a walk. I spin and I screech. That's just how it works. Part of the routine. And if it's been practiced for quite a long time, it's going to be a hard wiring to break. But often what we think about is his current response to stimulation of we need to go outside is to immediately spin and bark. So we need to teach him that there are other behaviors that are going to lead to my putting the leash on you and going outside. And when you first attempt this, it's going to take quite a bit of patience and time. So don't attempt it when you've got 5 minutes to let him out and then run out to work or to run an errand, because it may take longer than that. What you first want to do is make sure your dog knows how to sit really, really well. Like, he knows how to sit and he knows how to stay. And if he doesn't know that yet, I'd encourage you to work with a positive reinforcement-based trainer to get some of that basic training down. But of course, it sounds like he's pretty well-mannered, so I imagine he probably does know those things pretty well. And what you want to do is practice. Is it the side of the leash that triggers it?
Yes, the leash will trigger it, and I have tried, and because he minds really well when he's off the leash, I mean, I can just say, come here, and he'll come right to me, and he behaved. You know, we've tried it without the leash as well, and I've tried the set and stay, and until you're acting right, we're not walking out the door.
Sure.
But the minute he gets out the door, he starts it up.
Sure. And so what we can do is that the walk is over. We go back into the house and we start over again. We only proceed on the walk if we are showing good behavior. The other thing that might be helpful is to carry some sort of food magnet with you. So that could be like a pepperoni stick that you're holding in your hand. It could be a little jar of baby food. It could be anything that you could hold that he's focused his nose forward. And if his nose is focused forward, it's not going to be spinning. What you can teach him to do is just take 3 steps forward. 1, 2, 3, here's your little treat. 1, 2, 3, here's your little treat. And so sometimes food magnets, it's a way of cheating through getting from point A to point B, is just you're holding the leash with one hand, you're holding this food outstretched in front of his nose with the other, and teaching him to come forward. And if you can get in the routine of we sit, we stay, we clip on your leash, as long as you're good, that food comes to your mouth. We take a few steps forward, you get another treat with your mouth. A few more steps forward, we get another treat with your mouth. That way he's staying focused forward, because if he's spinning, he's not going to be able to follow it and eat.
Okay.
And if that's still a problem, then you might think about, like I said, a positive reinforcement-based trainer who can come to your house. Because sometimes just a second pair of eyes and experienced hands who's not part of that cycle that he's developed with you might be helpful.
All right. Good luck with that, Connie. In Worthington, Marjorie in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Marjorie.
Thanks. She's 5 and a half. I have a dog, and she loves people. However, when she approaches them, she's very, very shy, very nervous, sort of almost cowers, but she always wants to go see new people. And so I think, how do I, one, change that behavior, or even build confidence in her when she approaches new people, or even friends in the neighborhood that she knows?
Mm-hmm. Did you get her as a rescue, or you have her as a puppy?
We got her at 3 and a half months as a puppy.
Okay, so just a little bit beyond that socialization period. So even though she was pretty young, after 12 weeks, you know, you're depending on whoever had her before you as to socializing her with strangers and meeting new people.
Huh.
So it sounds like she maybe didn't have as much of that, and so she's a little shy about it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, often what I'll tell people to do is sort of set up greeting walks with people. So find some, clearly not in this weather, but in a few months or weeks when we get a little sunshine and warm weather, recruit friends and family to meet on a walk. And basically, often what I'll do is I'll teach them either to sit for a treat for new people, or to do something we call hand targeting, which is where someone holds their hand out and she learns to touch her nose to their hand. It's sort of like a little handshake greeting. And what you can do is you can set every person up to have a delicious treat with them. You want to teach her how to, you know, again, you can look online, you can look up handouts, or have a trainer work with you to teach her that hand targeting command, and basically get her to know that touch means look for the hand and touch your nose to it. And it's a fun little greeting that makes hands of other people less scary, and she learns she gets a treat from it. And so basically you just set up where you're going to pass 10 people on a circle and pass them again and pass them again, and she learns she goes up to somebody and she looks forward doing a safe, easy behavior and then getting a food treat from them. So that way it's predictable. There's also a food reward, which is positive for her, and that's going to help increase her confidence about meeting people. But you may have to purposely set it up And also talk to people about not immediately bending over her, getting in her face, reaching on top of her head, because she might be a little intimidated by that if she wasn't really well socialized to that kind of body language as a young, young puppy. And so if they can stay upright, avoid staring at her, avoid leaning over her. And actually, one of the first chapters in this book by Jackie Nielsen talks a lot about body language, reading the dog's body language and adjusting your own body language. So that might be a good thing to look into, as to sort of help give a guide to the people who are helping you work with her.
Marjorie, good luck with that. I want to take one more call before we take a quick break. Jeff and Bexley, you're on the air. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, I spoke to somebody earlier. I told them this kind of what's going on. I have a dog, wonderful little chihuahua, sweet as can be. He's 21 years old.
Oh, wow. That's great.
And, you know, he's kind of, I guess you could say, towards the end of his life cycle. My daughter comes home every 2 weeks and spoils him and loves him and, you know, regular stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he can barely stand up. He's blind. Mm-hmm. He's deaf.
Yeah.
He can't find his food bowl. He, you know, he falls over. Aww. He, you know.
Yeah.
When is it the right time?
Okay,
to do something.
It's a good question, Jeff. I'm so sorry.
It's a really good question, and it sounds like your dog has lived a wonderfully fabulous, long, great life. And you know, it's not many dogs that we have the privilege of spending that much of our lives with. So it's really great. I imagine it's really difficult to think about, you know, reaching the end stage. And you know, there's a few things I talk about. It's, you know, sort of. Before I forget, I want to say there's something we have at Ohio State called honoring the bond. So if you go to the OSU VMC's website, so that's vet.osu.edu, and you search for honoring the bond, you're going to find a lot of helpful information there on making those difficult decisions. And there are some checklists there to kind of go through. How do we assess for quality of life? Because that's really what you want for your dog. You want to know that he still has a quality of life. And if you feel like, for the most part, his days are not enjoyable and he's living sad and in pain and not doing well, then, you know, at that point, we may want to give him a kind, you know, restful ending. And so we think about, you know, is he aware of you? Does he have good positive interactions with a human being every day? Is he able to enjoy his food? Or, I mean, if you're able to help him find his food and set him up with something that smells really, really strong and that he could potentially enjoy, we can do that. But I would encourage you to look into some of those resources, and we do have people that can help you through some of these difficult decisions, because there's no black and white answer. And ultimately, you're going to know in your heart when it's the right time. But I think sometimes having an objective thing to look at and really help you make that decision, because it feels so difficult and emotional right now, it might be helpful for you.
Oh, Jeff, thank you so much for that call, and good luck. That's a tough one.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, really tough. Thank you so much. My guest is Dr. Megan Heron. She's an animal behavior expert at OSU's Veterinary Medical Center. The website that you mentioned for honoring the bond is vet.osu.edu.
Yes, I don't have the exact
sure, but you'll get to it from
there. But if you look up honoring the bond, you'll find that.
Okay. All right. So coming up, we're going to hear from the author of another new book, Rebecca Asher Walsh. The name of the book is Devoted, 38 Tales of Love, Loyalty, and Life with Dogs. Lots of great stories. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks to the internet, you could watch a new video about an amazing dog every single day. In fact, you could spend your entire day watching videos about amazing or funny or cute dogs. But when it comes to amazing, there's usually a human relationship involved. Still with us is dog behavior expert, author, and OSU professor Dr. Megan Heron. Joining us now by phone is Rebecca Asher Walsh. She's written a book about those exceptional dogs and the people that tapped into their gifts. The book is called Devoted, 38 Extraordinary Tales of Love, Loyalty, and Life with Dogs. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the more I read, the more I realized Devoted is more about more than just amazing dogs. It's about their connection to the people who ended up loving them. Why did you decide to write this book?
Oh, it was such a wonderful book to write, and I'm so glad that you picked up on that, because what I wanted to do was write about extraordinary dogs, but more important, what I wanted to do was write about extraordinary people made more extraordinary by their dogs, mm-hmm. because I realized at the end of the day, the stories that I were telling were really the ones about these people who were everyday people like the rest of us, and then something would happen with this dog, and they would change their lives. They would change other people's lives. And I just thought the idea that this beloved thing sitting at your feet every day could change your life was so amazing that I wanted to really examine that some more.
How did you decide what stories made the cut?
It was the ones that stayed with me, and it was mostly the ones where people went on to help other people mm-hmm. because their dog had helped them. So, for instance, this wonderful, wonderful vet who returned with post-traumatic stress and was suicidal, and his dog stopped him from killing himself, and then he went on to start a wonderful program that pairs shelter dogs with returning vets so that this doesn't happen anymore. Stories such as those where these people are going on and spreading their love into the world were the ones that I really, really wanted in there. And then I would alternate them with some just wonderful, fun stories, because not all of us have miraculous dogs. Not all of us have amazing stories. Some of us just have really cute dogs who do things like battle alligators and, make us laugh. My dog does none of those things, but I still love him.
Exactly. You know, that, Dr. Heron, that idea that this dog, in that case with the vet, jumped up in his lap. He had the gun on one thigh, and the dog jumped up on the other one and kind of put his head in against the guy's other arm, and that's what stopped him.
Mm-hmm.
And he
Amazing.
Thinks and he believes, and there are other stories in the book about dogs that intercede. They know that this mm-hmm. person they love, something's wrong. How do they
sure.
know that?
Sure. I mean, whether he knew his actual intent,
right.
not necessarily, but I would say dogs are very good at being sensitive to owner emotions and how they're feeling. Mm. And I definitely have experienced that firsthand, where you're having that day, you're really upset, and your dog is on you like glue. You know, they know that. I think dogs are very good at sensing our body language. They read our body language very well. I think they have less of the extraneous information to pay attention to and process. They really are looking at sort of your core body language and what that intent may be. And they sense distress. They sense trouble. I think a lot of them are very good at then offering these appeasement behaviors. They're trying to get you back. What's going on?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of bring you back to that more subtle, stable body language that they know and love and trust. So I believe that 100%, that they could sense, sure, that imagine what
Something's
agony he was in.
Yeah.
At that
That's
point.
That's a great, great mm-hmm. story. By the way, Rebecca, was very heartwarming and wonderful. You know, I think one of my favorites, of course, I say that in every single one I read was my favorite, but I think one of my favorites was the story about Ricochet, because at first she was being trained as a service dog. She came across as lazy or ADD or something because she could do it, but then she'd get bored and would just stop. But her owner found her gift.
Mm. You know, again, it connects a little bit back to what we were just talking about how dogs intercede and we think they're so extraordinary. But one of the things that kept coming up as we speak to behaviorists and experts is that when we think a dog is being so extraordinary, like Ricochet or, you know, like Cheyenne, the dog we were just talking about, they're just being good dogs and they're doing their doggy thing. And we just haven't figured out how to tap into that or how to recognize that. And Ricochet is a perfect example where the owner and breeder and trainer was determined that she would be a certain kind of service dog. And she had no interest in being that kind of a service dog. It just was not her thing. And, you know, I mean, now we're laughing about it. But
yeah,
when the owner talked to me, I mean, she said she went into a very deep depression.
She really felt strongly that you don't breed a dog just to have a breed. You
right.
breed them for
and
service.
This dog was going to turn off the damn light, which she told the dog to. And the dog was like, I just don't care. And what this dog is fantastic at is interacting with people and being athletic. And so what she has been able to help Ricochet do and is just amazing at is Ricochet rides surfboards with people with disabilities and helps balance out the surfboard since dogs can balance so well on their four legs. She loves the attention. She loves the athleticism of it. And these people, I mean, talking to these people, it's so, sorry, it makes me cry. It's so moving, these people who, you know, had given up on doing anything athletic, let alone surfing again or let alone learning how to surf. And this dog allows it to be possible. And it's just spectacular.
And she's helped raise a heck of a lot of money, too.
Heck of a lot of money, yeah.
Yeah. You include the story as well about the dog with arthritis. The dog that really became an internet sensation a few years ago because his owner was so wonderful to him.
Shep, wasn't that
sweet?
And that was one of those stories where, and this is, it's interesting to me how some of the quieter stories, when you talk to people about their love of their dog, it cuts through everything. So when I was listening to your show earlier about the man who has the Chihuahua who's lived some incredible 45 years or whatever it is.
25 or something like that.
25. Yeah. So it was something so foreign to those of us who have big dogs and amazing. But there's something so universal about people's love for their dogs and the issues that they go through with them that it cuts through anything else about what we might do or our jobs or where we live. And I think that that's what moves people so much about Shep and his owner was just this very quiet, loving bond. And again, this was a dog who had saved him from committing suicide, but that was years ago. And by the time I found them, they had just settled into this sweet life of taking care of each other with such tenderness that it just, I think it moved everybody.
Dr. Megan Heron, what is it about dogs that they can just keep going on and on and on in that way? It seems like we give up, but they don't. And so it is hard to know when it's gone too long.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
And they keep plugging away.
They keep plugging away. And I think each dog's a little different. And I think when you see that will to live, that strive to go on, and you know, you see that sparkle in their eye and you see that emotional connection that they're making, then, you know, as long as we feel like they're not in great physical pain, then we try to kind of provide that best quality life as we can. And then I think there's some where you kind of know, you see that look in their eye and they aren't feeling that connection. They aren't feeling that motivation. They're starting to withdraw. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of dogs will do that at the end of their life. We'll start to socially withdraw. You know, in a lot of cases, dogs or wild animals in nature will sort of retreat from the social group, sort of a means of kind of making their peaceful exit. And sometimes we'll see that with companion animals as well.
Rebecca Asher-Walsh, in your book, you talk about service dogs, of course, but you also talk about another kind of, you know, we usually think of those are about dogs that work with people who are blind or people who are physically disabled, but you also write about courthouse dogs, and I had not heard about that before.
Well, I found the first courthouse dog, and again, an extraordinary dog who was just doing her job, which was being close to people. And what she was able to do was accompany a young teenager who had been repeatedly raped by a family member and was testifying against him. And obviously this was extremely traumatic. And her wonderful, wonderful, wonderful psychiatrist wanted to make it as least stressful as possible. Obviously, it was going to be extremely stressful. Then found this group in Seattle and started researching courthouse dogs and did everything he could do to make this happen. And this beautiful, beautiful golden retriever went in with the girl. And what would happen was that as the girl, if her heart rate would start to rise, the dog would sense that and lean up against her. And she would be able to pet the dog, and that it would calm her and calm the dog. And she would be able to go on and tell the story. And they are now working on legislation to get courtyard dogs into every courtroom throughout New York at this point, because it was so important.
And then there was an interesting story. You know, I know Dr. Heron, we know now that a lot of you can predict domestic violence when it begins with a pet.
Mm-hmm.
And Rebecca Asher Walsh, she wrote about a dog whose owner would not leave him behind because she knew would not in the process of leaving an abusive partner, because she knew that the dog would be hurt, or she was afraid for the dog, and that she started to change things there too.
Well, and again, a woman who has changed the world because, thanks to refusing to give up her great giant Great Dane, she brought the Great Dane to the shelter, which thought it would be a very quick turnaround. But of course, it isn't a quick turnaround when you're trying to get your life back together. So the people in charge of the shelter realized how beneficial this dog was, and they have now built the first on-site shelter for the animals of the families who are leaving an abusive relationship. And two of the extraordinary things that they said about this that really just moved me beyond words was that exactly what you just said, that many women will not leave an abusive relationship with their children because the partner tells them they will kill their pet. So they stay for the pet because they know that that's true. And then the second thing that was so extraordinary was the woman who ran the shelter said that what they saw was that the family started to get back on track much faster because they would come to the shelter, of course, very traumatized and very shut down. But they said at the end of the day, the family would take the dog for a walk together. And there was this moment of being together and having something to talk about. And she also spoke about children and that children are incredibly resilient and that they can leave their home and leave their schools and change their lives. But she said often losing the family pet is what breaks them. And because this one grown woman stood up and said, I am not coming to a shelter without my dog, she has changed the lives of hundreds of families who will now be able to find sanctuary with their dog or cat.
I want to squeeze in a few calls right now, Rebecca. Deb in Mansfield, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, Deb.
I have a little pug corgi mix. She is in training to be a service dog, which I think is ironic.
Mm-hmm.
The one issue I have with her, she is a rescue. The one issue I have is the shelter she was in, they sprayed the cages down with the dogs in it daily.
Oh.
So she has a massive fear of water. Even if her water bowl splashes, she won't go near the water bowl. And I've
What do you do?
Yeah, we're adding fluid to her food, but how do I get her past the fear of water?
Dr. Heron, any suggestions?
Sure, it's probably something that she needs put a long, sort of complicated plan to really work her through those fears. It sounds like they're pretty profound, where she's actually maybe panicking at the sight of that. I mean, just for a water to splash is a pretty profound trigger. So usually when you're working with a dog, whether it's a fear of water, fear of the toaster, fear of a certain floor, is you want to try, if you can find a baseline amount of water or level of water or area of water that does not elicit panic from her, we start there. Usually we start by teaching them a calm, relaxed, downstay behavior that's associated with some sort of place. And then we find that baseline spot of water. So maybe that's just a plate that has a little drop of water. Not that it makes any noise, but maybe she can just see the side of it. And she learns she can sit in her safe mat and get food treats and, you know, be rewarded for calm, relaxed behavior. We start just at a level that she can handle. And I don't know where that level is for her. That's going to take some experimenting. And then, you know, just like if it was a dog worried about thunderstorms.
Yeah.
I would have the sound of the thunder starting at such a low level that it elicited no response. And over time, as she's in this relaxed state, getting food as sort of a, you know, powerful emotional encouragement, we would slowly increase that over time. It's just a matter of finding the level of water, the type of water, the receptacle for that water, how much noise that water makes, and working her up from where her baseline is now to where she can be later. And if you're having trouble, she has no baseline, because there are some dogs who are bad. Sometimes you can talk to your veterinarian about some medications that may be helpful to accelerate that a little better.
Okay, Deb in Mansfield, thanks for that question. I will never rue the day my dog discovered a puddle again. Rebecca Asher Walsh, thanks so much for joining us to talk about your new book.
Thank you so much for having me on. Thank you, Dr. Heron. I loved hearing your wisdom.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to reading the rest of your book. It looks wonderful.
Rebecca Asher-Wall, she's the author of Devoted, 38 Tales of Love, Loyalty, and Life with Dogs, and also Dr. Megan Heron. She's an animal behavior expert, head of the Behavioral Medicine Clinic at the Ohio State University Veterinary Medical Center. Thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.